Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm George Smith, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for the program. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, President James M. Carter, Jr. As many of you know, the Commonwealth Club is proud to have had virtually every U.S. president since Theodore Roosevelt's address to our audience, though not all of them. Today, we're honored to have with us an American president we've wanted for a very long time, the 39th president and founder of the Carter Center, President Jimmy Carter. Let me just say a few words about his background. James Earl Carter, Jr., was the 39th president of the United States and founded the Carter Center, which advances global health and resolution. In 2002, President Carter was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his decades of untiring effort to find peaceful solutions to international conflicts. Jimmy Carter was born in the small farming town of Plains, Georgia. He was educated in public school, attended Georgia Institute of Technology, and received a Bachelor of Science degree in 1946. From the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. He became a submarine officer, serving in both the Atlantic and Pacific fleets. Chosen by Admiral Hyman Rickover for the nuclear submarine program at Union College in Schenectady, New York, he studied nuclear physics and served as senior officer of the pre-commissioning crew of the Seawolf, the second nuclear submarine. Carter became governor of Georgia in 1971 and was elected U.S. president in 1976. It was in 1976 that many here in San Francisco first met Jimmy Carter. I remember the day. His son's ship came down Montgomery Street in advance of a procession crying out, "He's coming, he's coming," sounding a little like first century Palestine, where something really important might have been happening. Chip plotted out a grassroots campaign, state by state, across the country, and they won. Significant foreign policy accomplishments of the Carter administration include the Panama Canal treaties, the Camp David Accords, the Treaty of Peace between Egypt and Israel, the SALT II Treaty with the Soviet Union, establishment of U.S. diplomatic relationship with the People's Republic of China. The Carter Center advances health and agriculture in the developing world and is engaged in conflict mediation in Ethiopia, North Korea, Haiti, Bosnia, the Sudan, and Colombia, as well as 91 election monitoring missions to the Americas, Africa, and Asia, most recently to Tunisia and Egypt. I was privileged to join the election monitoring in Nicaragua and in China. We have not mentioned his better half, Rosalind Carter. And further to that, the Carters have 3 sons, 1 daughter, 9 grandsons, 3 granddaughters, 2 great-grandsons, and 4 great-granddaughters. It is a pleasure to introduce President Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'll still follow. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, first of all, let me say that I'm glad to be here. This is not something that I do very often, but I came because of my, the influence and pressure from George Smith, my good friend. And when George asked me to do something, it's very hard to say no. Also, I wanted to follow in the footsteps of my wife, who was here 2 years ago, and I can't hope to fill those shoes, but I'll do the best I can. This is an event that is nice to me because it illustrates the advantage of being a former president. I was trying to think of a few advantages of being a former president. That's one of them. But it came to me most clearly when the year after I left the White House, I was invited to go to China, and we traveled all over China as guest of a government. And then we came back through Japan, and I was invited to make a speech at a small college down in the southern part of Japan near Osaka. And when I got there, it was graduation day at the college. And the audience was fairly small because the student body was small. And we had an interpreter that was very good. And I began to make my speech, I would say one sentence and he would interpret it, then I'd say a couple of sentences he'd interpret it. It takes a lot longer to say something in Japan than it does in Japanese than it does in English. And finally, I decided that the audience was so nervous because of my presence having just been president of the United States that I would tell a joke to loosen the audience up. And instead of telling my best joke, I just told my shortest joke to get it over with. And when I got through, I had the best reaction to a joke I've ever had in my life. I couldn't wait till my speech was over to go to the green room and ask the interpreter, "How did you tell my joke?" He was very evasive. But I insisted. I said, "You got to tell me, you know, how you told that joke, so I can do it later on." He said, "Well, I told the audience, President Carter told a funny story. Everyone must laugh." So you see, there are some advantages in being a president, and being here is one of them. I know that we're going to have a question and answer period later on, and I'm going to cover some things here that might not be popular with some of you. But I spend my time now at the Carter Center. I've been a professor at Emory University now for 31 years. This is my 31st year, and I belong to an organization called the Elders. And the best way to describe them is a group of political has-beens. One of them is Nelson Mandela. Another one is his wife. Another one is Archbishop Tutu. Another one is Kofi Annan, who has been the Secretary General of the United Nations. Another is President Cardoso, the former president of Brazil. Another one is the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, the former prime minister of Norway. Gro Brundtland, who was later the head of WHO, and so forth. There are 10 of us now. Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma was a member, but we have a rule that if you hold public office, you can't be a member of the Elders. So she stepped down when she was recently elected to the parliament. And this is a group that has some special privileges. We go where we wish, we meet with whom we choose, and we say what we want. We try to tell the truth, whether it hurts or not, and I'm going to maybe do a little of that today. I'm going to talk about the title of my speech that I gave several months ago is The Challenges of a Superpower. And, of course, America is now the world's unchallenged superpower in many ways. And I would say that this is a time of assessing what America is and what the future of our country should be. The American heritage, I would say, that is a time of challenge. We have habitually or historically risen to greatness. And we realize that in a democracy like ours, that change from challenge to greatness is a matter of responsibility for individual citizens. And that's what I am, just a private citizen like you. What are the goals of a great nation? I would say they're the same as the goals of a great person. They're the goals that have been established most clearly in the religions that we might adopt as our own. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, and so forth. And they are all the same. There's really no incompatibility between a desire on the part of a human being to be a superb human being in the eyes of whatever God we worship than it is for a nation to say, I want to be a superb nation. I want to be a genuine superpower in all the meaning of the word. So what are those characteristics? I would say it would be a commitment to peace, a commitment to justice, a commitment to freedom or democracy, a commitment to human rights, to protecting the environment that we've inherited, to sharing our wealth with others. I think those are the hallmarks of a superpower. Let's look at America for a moment. Let's talk about peace, first of all. Since World War II, we've been almost constantly at war. In Korea, and then Vietnam, Cambodia, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Grenada, Libya, Panama, Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Iraq, Afghanistan. I don't know about the future. Iran, Syria, Mali. You get the point. Our country is now looked upon as the foremost warlike nation on earth. And there is almost a complete dearth now of a commitment of America to negotiate differences with others. It's not just Democrats or Republicans or a particular president. It's a consciousness or attitude of Americans like you and me. I'm not a pacifist. As George pointed out, my career was as a naval officer. When I was 6 years old, that's all I wanted to do was to be a naval officer, and I went to Annapolis. And I served on 2 battleships and 3 submarines. I was willing to give my life, if necessary, to protect the interests of my country. I'm not against protecting ourselves. I believe in a strong defense and worked for that when I was president. As a matter of fact, since the Civil War era, the only president that's had more military service than I was Eisenhower. Well, we need to be working for peace for others as well as ourselves. When my wife and I were on the way to the inauguration last month, we tried to think of anywhere on earth right now that the United States has a major commitment to bring peace to other people. I can't think of a place. The Mideast is a typical need, has a typical need for peace. This is the first time in more than 50 years when the United States has not been trying to bring peace to Israel and its neighbors. Well, let's look at human rights. America was a nation that was the foremost committed to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was passed with Eleanor Roosevelt's leadership when the United Nations was first formed. And for many times during the interim period, we've been the champion of human rights. That's no longer the case. Look up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on your computer, you'll find there are 30 paragraphs. And our staff at the Carter Center has determined that we are now violating 10 of those 30 paragraphs. We've now disavowed the application of the Geneva controls on treatment of prisoners at war. And you know there's been a lot of altercation back and forth lately about the use of drones to assassinate Americans, even in foreign countries, or not excluding within the United States. We have 166 people at Guantanamo now. Half of them have never been tried at all. They never have been accused of a crime. And all of them at Guantanamo now are faced with the prospect of serving the rest of their lives in prison. Our president has announced that we have the right to send people to prison for life without a trial, without legal counsel, and without any specific charge against them. This is a policy toward human rights that is usually accepted, particularly since 9/11, when the restraints on human rights and commitments to human rights were very firm and unequivocal in the United States. There's some other things that need to be at least discussed. We're the only industrialized nation on earth that still has a death penalty. In fact, 90% of all the executions in the world are in four countries: Saudi Arabia, China, Iran, and the United States. We have the highest prison population by far in the world. When I left office in 1980, we had a very low prison population. For every one person in prison then, we now have 7.5 in prison. 7 times as many people as we had in prison. And almost all of the people in prison, a large proportion of them, are poor or minorities or mentally retarded. In fact, the largest mental institution in the United States is the prison in Los Angeles. Let's look at justice or equity. I was asked to make a speech, two speeches as a matter of fact, when 2000 rolled around. And the subject that I was assigned was, what's the greatest challenge that the world faces in the new millennium? And my decision was, it was its growing chasm, increasing chasm between rich people and poor people. Well, we have that in our country as well. Since I left office in 1980 again, the income for the top 1% of Americans has doubled, and the income for the top 1/100th of a percent has quintupled because of our political system permitting the more powerful people, the richer people, to prevail in changing income tax laws and so forth. High school rates in America for the first time last year stopped climbing since 1890, and the portion of family income for tuition in either public or private institutions has increased from 4% of average income to 10% of a family's income. In Americans in poverty has increased 31% in just in the last 5 years. Democracy, you know the state of our democratic process now. When I ran for office, first of all, as a peanut farmer, as a governor, against incumbent Gerald Ford, for the general election, you know how much money we raised? Zero. When I ran 4 years later against your governor, Ronald Reagan, we raised zero. We just used a $2 per person checkoff. And now there's a massive infusion of money into the primary and general election system. Unrestricted by the stupid decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. And most of that money, as you well know, is spent on negative commercials to destroy the reputation of your opponent. And that has fragmented or divided Americans into red and blue states, and also has divided candidates against one another, so that when they finally get to Washington, there's no compatibility detectable now between Democratic and Republican senators or members of Congress, or between a House that's Republican and a Democratic president. And the blame is both ways. It's not just one way. We haven't had a federal budget now in 5 years. And about 40% of everything we spend out of the federal government now has to be borrowed. And there's no concerted effort to address the roughly $1 trillion deficit each year. The environment. Up until, I'd say, George Bush Sr., America was in the forefront of nations on earth promoting a good environment and dealing with global warming. We're now one of the laggard countries. The Europeans and many others are moving ahead of us. Well, I'm not criticizing my country, which I think is the best nation on earth, and I'm very proud to have served at it, as its leader. But I'm pointing out to you that in this time of assessment, I'd say particularly for my 23 children and grandchildren, which George enumerated, and for the students that I've taught now for 31 years, and for other young people at least, we need to look at what are the possibilities for improving. Rosa and I, for the last, since I left the White House, involuntarily retired by the 1980 election, have formed the Carter Center. We now have programs in 73 countries on earth. 35 of them, not accidentally, are in Africa. And we try to deal with these same principles that I've just outlined to you in kind of a negative way. We try to go to countries and promote peace where the United States is somewhat or totally alienated from them. The Carter Center, we go to Cuba regularly. We go to North Korea regularly. We have full-time offices in Jerusalem and Ramallah and also in Gaza City. And we deal with both sides within the Palestinian community, as well as with Israel and with Jordan and with Egypt and with Lebanon. And even with Syria now, we deal with both sides in the terrible civil war going on in Syria. We see the adverse impact of 60 years of economic embargo as we strive to destroy the economy of the people of Cuba, who are already suffering under dictatorships, as you know. The same thing in North Korea. I go to North Korea every now and then. And I go into the countryside of North Korea and I see the starving children where the World Health Organization and the United Nations Food Fund measures the upper arms of 10-year-old children that are just about as big around as a golf ball. And we have a punitive embargo against them, also having lasted now for 60 years. We try to change that. We try to promote freedom and democracy when countries are facing a challenge in their governments. The Carter Center does. We just finished our 93rd troubled election in Sierra Leone. And in that Mono River Basin area of Western Africa, which includes also Cote d'Ivoire and Guinea and Liberia, it's just a typical place. As the Arab Spring or Arab Awakening took place, the Carter Center has been there. We've been in Egypt for 2 years as Egypt struggles to form a new government. And I'll be going back very shortly again. We did the election in Tunisia. We did the election in Libya. We did the first election in the biggest Muslim country on earth, Indonesia, following 50 years of dictatorship. So we try to bring freedom and democracy there to those countries as they struggle for freedom and democracy. We also work on health care, the sharing of what we have with poor people. One of the basic principles of the Carter Center is to fill vacuums in the world. And over a period of time, our budget, which started out just trying to promote peace between countries or peace between the United States and other countries, shifted toward democracy, which we originated, the monitoring of election, and then primarily to treating five what the World Health Organization calls neglected tropical diseases. One of these is a disease called onchocerciasis or rubber blindness. I just came back from Mexico this week. I was down there because we have almost completely eliminated rubber blindness from Latin American countries. We just have one little tribe of 24,000 members totally that has any more onchocerciasis or rubber blindness, and that will be eliminated within the next 2 years. We won't have any rubber blindness left in Latin America. We get free medicine from major pharmaceutical companies like Merck and Company. They give us free medicine to treat river blindness. Last year, we treated 12.8 million people with free medicine from Merck and Company. We distributed a total of 160 million doses of Mectizan, they call it. We also have dealt with trachoma, which is the number one cause of blindness, except for cataracts. We've administered 75 million cases of free Zithromax, which is an antibiotic. And we performed, the Carter Center last year performed 40% of the total surgeries on earth for trachoma. Trachoma is a disease caused by filthy eyes, where flies get around children's eyes and adults' eyes and cause infection. And the upper eyelid turns inward, so every time you blink your eye, the eyelashes slash the cornea, and that causes blindness. We also have built in Africa, encourage the people to build 2.3 latrines, outdoor toilets. I'm not known in Africa as the one who brought peace between Israel and Egypt. I'm known as the person who builds the most latrines on earth. Guinea worm is another case. Guinea worm is caused by drinking filthy water from a rain pond where it doesn't rain but just two or three months a year, and the people get a worm inside their body, which 12 months later is about 30 to 36 inches long, and it stings the inside of the epidermis and causes a terrible infection that destroys muscle tissue. We found nobody else wanted to deal with this disease because it affects isolated villages in the desert areas and also in the jungle areas, and we decided to take it on. We found 3.5 million cases in 20 countries, three in Asia and the rest of them in sub-Saharan Africa. 26,500 villages had guinea worm. We've been to every village, and we've taught the people what to do so they won't have the disease. We've reduced now 3.5 million cases. Last year, we had 542 cases on Earth. And within a couple of years, we'll have our last case of guinea worm, which will be in South Sudan, which is a new nation that we helped form by monitoring their elections and letting them have a referendum. So this is the kind of thing that just a small NGO will do. I didn't come here to brag about what we are doing, but I came to point out that these are apparently intransigent problems that our country faces and that every one of you individually faces and I face are not insoluble. If we set our goals high and are determined to work in harmony with each other, no matter what our social status or what our political alienation or affiliation might be, to work in harmony in this great country, this is what we need to assess. In closing my remarks so I can answer your questions, let me just say that I believe that all of us would agree that our country, the United States of America, should be a champion of peace. We should be a champion of justice. We should be a champion of human rights. We should be a champion of environment. We should be a champion of alleviating suffering among other people on earth. This is what I think are the challenges of a superpower. Thank you.
Our thanks to President Jimmy Carter. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for today's audience question period. President Carter, we have a huge number of questions.
I see that. Yeah.
So let's begin.
Do I get to choose the ones I want?
If you'd like. Let's start with a couple of questions I'm going to roll together concerning the nuclear situation in North Korea and Iran. Is the situation dangerous? How does it contrast North Korea versus the Iranian nuclear situation? And why does the U.S. have no clout when it comes to influencing settlement policy?
By settlement policy, you're still talking about the nuclear thing, not settlements in the West Bank.
Yeah.
Okay, but just want to be sure. Well, I think there's a very close parallelism between Iran and North Korea. I've been going to North Korea quite regularly since 1994, when we were on the verge of a war between North and South Korea, and I went over and negotiated with Kim Il-sung, and then President Clinton followed up and had an agreement of, in all issues, including no nuclear program in North Korea, that was consummated in Geneva a little bit later on. Unfortunately, when George W. Bush became president, he threw that agreement in the wastebasket. And at that time, North Korea, who is very paranoid and very isolated, as you know, and very dominated by dictatorship, decided that they would go all out to defend themselves by creating nuclear capability. The first thing that they did was to purify spent nuclear rods from inside two very small power plants that I knew about then. The world knew about it. And they agreed not to do that anymore. But that's the way you make plutonium, and that's what they have now. It's probably the capability of 4 or 5 or 6 plutonium bombs. They just exploded another one, as you know, this past month. We don't know if it was purified uranium, which takes a lot longer, or just the plutonium made out of spent fuel. So I think that the North Koreans are going to have a good enough judgment not to be suicidal, because they know that if they ever use a nuclear weapon against South Korea or anywhere else, that the United States will wipe them off the map, because we have 5,000 very advanced nuclear weapons. I think the same thing exists in Iran. My hope is that we can prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, and I'm not sure at this point, and no one else is either, that Iran leaders have decided to go with a nuclear capability, that is a nuclear bomb capability. They have now purified their uranium in centrifuges. They have thousands of them, up to about 20% of pure U-235, which is the explosive component of uranium. Most of it is 238, which is not explosive. And so this is something that's a challenge for us. And so my hope is that we can negotiate with them. There was a deal worked out between Brazil and Turkey and Iran earlier that said that they could go up to 20%. Iran agreed to say okay, and they would let the international inspectors come in. So far, the United States has never offered Iran to lift all the economic sanctions if they would agree on limiting their nuclear capability to 20% and letting the IAEA, the inspection, come in and see about them. But even if Iran should develop, this is the worst case, and I hope it doesn't happen, if they should develop 2 or 3 nuclear weapons, then they know that if they should challenge Israel, for instance, with one of their nuclear weapons, Israel has, I don't know, 200 nuclear weapons of a very advanced nature. We have 5,000, and I'm not sure that the Iranians are suicidal enough to want to have their own country wiped off the map by challenging Israel. So my own preference is that we negotiate with Iran and negotiate with North Korea as well, because we have not been willing to even talk to North Korea for a number of years. There's been not a single day of talks with North Korea since President Obama has been in office. I've been there twice since then. But what they want is to have a peace treaty with the United States. So far, we just have a ceasefire between the United States and North Korea, left over from the end of the nuclear war 60 years ago. So there's a lot of parallelism between them. I don't believe either one of those countries is going to be suicidal enough to use nuclear weapons. I hope we can prevent their nuclear weapons by good faith talks with both countries.
Thank you. Mr. President, this questioner asks, first off, I am a supporter of your views on the Middle East policy, but I have no definite answer on what prevents real progress in the Israel-Arab conflict. What is Israel's position? What is the Arabs' one? And why, again, does the U.S. have no clout when it comes to influencing Israeli settlement policy? And the final question, whose fault is most significant?
Uh-oh. Well, as I said in my talks, this is the first time since Israel has been a nation that the United States has, you might say, zero influence either in Jerusalem or among the Palestinians. And I'm very grieved about that and hope that this upcoming visit by John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, to Israel, and then followed up by the first visit by President Obama to Israel will be meaningful. After he was first elected president, President Obama went to Cairo, as you may know, and called for zero settlements, in increase in the Israeli settlements in Palestine. And he also called for later that the 67 borders around Israel, modified by good faith talks, would be the prevailing premise for peace. That is generally called by a two-state solution, with Israel living within its borders, modified slightly, and with the Palestinians living within their borders in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, side by side with mutual respect and in peace. That's what everybody hopes for. My own belief, with which many of you may disagree, is that Prime Minister Netanyahu, for the first time, has decided on a one-state solution, because under his administration, Israel has been madly building settlements in East Jerusalem and also all the West Bank. Nobody wants Gaza. And this means that it's becoming decreasingly viable or likely that you can have a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel. And so I'm very discouraged about that, and the only thing that can be done about it is for the United States to play a major role. And if President Obama will go back to the two premises that he had earlier, no more Israeli settlements in Palestine, and the 67 borders would prevail between the two, modified to accommodate the large settlements that's right outside of Jerusalem, then that would be the best solution. I think the Arab world will accept this. On two or three occasions already, every Arab country, in fact, every Muslim country, even including Iran, has agreed that that is a premise that they will accept, and that they will recognize Israel equal to all the Arab countries with trade, commerce, and diplomatic relations. But so far, that has not been possible. And I don't think the Israelis are going to do it unless the United States plays a very strong role. I met with some Israeli leaders last week at the Carter Center who came to visit me. They believe that if President Obama goes to Israel and makes that strong call for a two-state solution based on what I've just said twice, that the 60% at least of Israeli citizens will agree with him. I think the recent election in Israel showed that Prime Minister Netanyahu had gone too far along the road toward ending the possibility for a two-state solution. It's a very complex situation. I fumbled through my answer, but I've written two or three books about the subject. Maybe you can buy one of my books, and then you can get the answers.
Still staying in the Middle East, please comment on Egypt. What are your expectations for their government and the relationship of Egypt with the United States?
Well, I know Egypt quite well. In fact, when the Carter Center has been in Egypt, that I mentioned in my earlier talk, for 2 years, and I'll be going back again for the fourth time to see Egypt overcome 50-something years of dictatorship and move in a fumbling way toward honest and free and fair elections. There have been three elections so far for the parliament and for president, and every one of them has been honest and fair. That is, they have accurately expressed the will of the people who went to the polls and voted. As you know, the Muslim Brotherhood prevailed and came in first in both the parliament and also the presidential election, but that's not hard to comprehend because 90% of the people in Egypt are Muslims. And you couldn't expect the 10% of the Coptic Christians, for instance, to prevail. And my own belief is that the Muslim Brotherhood and the elected president, Mohamed Morsi, are moderate in comparison with some of the other extremes. I know President Morsi quite well. He's an engineer. He was educated here in California, Southern Cal. That's where he got his Ph.D. in engineering. When I first met him, he was a dean of the engineering school in Cairo. And he had no idea that he would ever be running for president. But the way things happened, he did run because some other candidates were disqualified. I think he's struggling to bring about a moderate government in Egypt because it's to Egyptians' benefit to be accepted as a moderate government, respecting human rights and so forth, by the rest of the world if they want to have trade, commerce, tourism, and so forth. So this is a very, very difficult issue. They have fumbled. They finally have a constitution. It's not perfect, but it's a constitution. And he just took office in May or June, and they got a constitution in December. A lot of us in this audience might say, well, they should have done better than that. But it took the United States 12 years to get a constitution. After we declared our independence in 1776, it was 12 years later before we finally had our constitution approved. I think we have to be patient with them. My own belief is that the so-called Arab Spring or Arab Awakening has been potentially a very good move. In all three countries that I mentioned, which the Carter Center has monitored every election, it's been a move from dictatorship to freedom and democracy. And we may not approve the leaders that the people elect. I think as time goes on, every one of those institutions of government will be more moderate, more accommodating to the outside world because of our own potential benefit economically and politically.
Would you please comment on Turkey's role on the stabilization of the social and economic landscape in the Middle East? Do you see Turkey as a role model for secular democratic governments in the Middle East?
Well, Turkey, as you know, is potentially going to become a member of the European Union. I hope it will. The Turks have made a great strides in my political lifetime, which is not all that long, in becoming more moderate. They have abandoned their military dictatorship and moved to a government of a Muslim nature, but it's quite moderate in its attitudes. I think Turkey has worked harmoniously with the United States government, the Turkish government has, and they have become, I think, a stabilizing factor. In fact, when I go to Egypt and read their newspapers or hear their comments on radio at night or television, they quite often refer to Turkey as a model for the future government of Egypt. So it's setting a fairly good example. It's been quite critical of what's going on in Syria, which I can certainly understand. So I believe that Turkey in the future is going to continue to be increasingly influential in a beneficial way in the Middle Eastern region. They are antagonistic toward Iran, as you know. They are fairly compatible with Egypt. They're fairly compatible in the past with Israel until they had an altercation about the ship a couple of years ago. So I think in general, to answer your question, Turkey is playing a strong role. It's going to increase. I think it'll be a moderating and positive factor.
Thank you. I'm going to turn now to the Carter Center. Can the Carter Center do anything to improve human rights and diplomacy for peace here in the United States? With the help of the Carter Center and the passage of time, much has improved abroad. What can the Carter Center do to improve U.S. policies here in the United States?
I would say that the Carter Center takes an idealistic, you might want to call it a naive approach to human rights, excuse me, because we have publicly come out against the unlimited use of drones to assassinate people without trial and without any judicial oversight. We faced the same basic problem when I was president, and we passed what's called FISA, which established a group of senior judges who could act very expeditiously if the CIA or any other intelligence agency wanted to tap your telephone. And if the executive branch wanted to tap your telephone, they had to go to this FISA court, who would then decide yes or no. I think that's something that President Obama might want to consider in the future, is either a blue ribbon commission, maybe not having to be judges, that is in the judicial system, but having some way to monitor to make sure that this is not abused, because we've now killed four Americans overseas. One of them was a member of Al-Qaeda. He wasn't threatening immediate attacks on the United States, but long term. His 16-year-old son was also killed, and two other Americans. So I would like to see some very tight restraints that America, private citizens like you and me, and the Congress could understand this is a procedure that's being used, and if an American is assassinated by a drone, that has been the control of it. We are very much against the death penalty. As a matter of principle, I would like to see the death penalty eliminated. As a matter of fact, when I happened to be governor and happened to be president, nobody was executed because the Supreme Court at that time had put a hold on all capital punishment impositions. And I wrote an op-ed piece that was in the LA Times when you were getting ready to vote recently on whether or not California would continue with the death penalty. I was against it. You voted to keep it. And one of the things I pointed out was that you have executed, I think, 13 people in the last 15 or 20 years, and the average cost per person executed by California has been $307 million. So that's how much you spend every time you execute a person. And my own belief is that the threat of death, the death penalty is not a deterrent to crime, and I put a lot of things in my editorial about it. If you want to look those two editorials up against the drones and against the death penalty, you can do that. But the Carter Center works with human rights organizations all over the world. We work with Amnesty International, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, a whole gamut of them. And every year we have what we call a defenders conference where we bring in human rights defenders or human rights heroes to the Carter Center to consider a key issue. This year, the issue will be women's rights. And we're going to go to Cairo. We're going to Cairo, Egypt, to have the conference. It'll be in June. And we'll have human rights heroes come from 40-something, 45 countries, plus religious leaders who will come to Cairo to meet with us. And we've got the support not only from President Morsi, whom I've just mentioned to you, but also from the Grand Imam of so-called Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar is the university in Cairo that has 120,000 students, and he's the president of a university. He's also the number one Sunni Muslim on earth. He's the one that gives the philosophy or the interpretation of the scriptures for the Sunni Muslims. And he's helping us with our conference because he wants to see religion stop being a cause of abuse of women. There's no doubt in my mind that this is a case because I was a Southern Baptist until the year 2000 when my wife and I withdrew in protest when the Southern Baptists derogated women's to a subordinate position. A woman now in the Southern Baptist Convention, for instance, can't be a preacher, she can't be a deacon, she can't even, if she is in a Southern Baptist seminary, she can't even teach male students. And as you know, the Catholic Church does not let women be priests, and the Islamic world also derogates women in some cases. And in Saudi Arabia, a woman can't drive a car. And I think that when a men are inclined to abuse women, the best excuse they can make is, well, if God doesn't consider a woman to be equal to man, why should I treat my wife as my equal? Why should I treat my women employees as equal to a male employee if God thinks that women are inferior? So this is a basic thrust of a conference in June, and that's the kind of things that the Carter Center does on drones and on the death penalty and on women's rights and so forth in human rights.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is President Jimmy Carter. This questioner in the audience says, I participated in the guinea worm eradication program in Ghana, and thank you for your work. How did you come to learn of guinea worm, and what gave you and the Carter Center the hope that it could be eradicated?
My drug czar in the White House was a man named Dr. Peter Bourne. And when he and I both left the White House, he went to the United Nations and became Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. And he was assigned the responsibility for the decade of water. And so his charge was to analyze the impact of water on people's health and well-being. And he found that this particular disease was one of the worst diseases that came out of water, and it was not addressed by anybody else because it was so intractable and so widespread and so uncertain. So he came to the Carter Center and made us talk to us one day, and so then we decided to do it. And right next door to the Carter Center is a Centers for Disease Control, and so we were able to steal the best people out of the Centers for Disease Control, because one of the men there, Dr. Don Hopkins, was working on guinea worm. He had been instrumental in eradicating smallpox earlier, and he wanted to come and work full-time on this project. He couldn't do it in CDC, but he could do it at the Carter Center. So that's how we got involved in it. So we started a tour of the world. I did personally. I went first to Pakistan and then to Yemen and then to India and then all across Canada, and we found the countries that did have guinea worm, and that's when we started eradicating it one by one. There's zero cases in Ghana anymore, and there's zero cases in 17 of the countries. In fact, of the 542 cases, 521 of those cases are in southern Sudan, and the rest of the world only has 21 cases. And we know every case and every village, and we have every one of those people that have guinea worm now under our control so they don't go back in the water and start the disease all over again. So we're getting now very near the end of guinea worm on Earth.
Mr. President, you recently met with the new Chinese leader.
Yes.
This questionnaire wants to know your impression of him and which direction he will lead China to, and can you tell us how you look at the relationship between the U.S. and China, especially from the economy and human rights perspectives?
As I first visited China in 1949, I was on a submarine, and this was the last few weeks before the Nationalist Chinese left the mainland and the Communist Chinese took over. And so I've had a very high interest in China ever since. When I became president, we had been 35 years alienated from China, and our diplomatic relation was only with Taiwan. And I decided that I would normalize relations with China, and we were able to do that. And it was announced the 15th day of December 1978, and it took effect the first day of 1979. Anyway, since then, I've gone to China quite often. The Chinese government trusts me and the Carter Center in an extraordinary way. For instance, they have authorized the Carter Center with a contract with the government to monitor all the 650,000 villages in China, and they are purely democratic elections. Everybody in those little villages is automatically registered to vote when they reach the age of 18. They have a secret ballot. The candidates can run for office whether they're communist or not, and most of them are not members of the Communist Party. They can run for re-election after 3 years and that sort of thing. So the Carter Center has monitored that for 15 years. We also are helping the Chinese now with their relationship with African countries, and we also are helping the Chinese implement a freedom of information law to let the people of China know what their government is doing. And the Chinese government, by the way, calls on us to do this. Xi Jinping has been a friend of mine for many years. I've met four different times with Xi Jinping since I knew that he was going to be the next leader of China. And he will be ordained next month when the National People's Congress convenes. He's been to the United States once. And I've also met with Li Keqiang, who will be the vice premier of China beginning next month. So I know the Chinese leaders very well. When I was there in December for the last time 2 months ago, they were very deeply concerned about the attitude of the United States toward them with the new move by President Obama to the Pacific and with the stationing of 2,500 Marines in Australia and things like that. I need not go into detail about it. But also they had a windmill project in Oregon, and President Obama declared that the windmill project of China would be a threat to our security. So some of those things and the rhetoric that you heard from Governor Romney and also to a lesser degree from President Obama in the last election, the Chinese monitor every one of those words, and they try to interpret what these candidates mean in their attitude toward China. So China is very concerned about the attitude of America toward them in the future. I think we're going to be competitive in many ways. When I travel around the world, and my wife and I have been to more than 140 countries, now you see that the Chinese are very influential all over Africa, all over Latin America, and I think are forming contracts for politics and for economic benefits. I think in the future, China wants to stay peaceful. I mentioned just a list of wars that we have been in since the Second World War a while ago. It's a long list, and I didn't name them all. When I normalized relations with Deng Xiaoping, the next morning, by the way, when he met with me, he said he had a secret message he had to give me that China was going to invade Vietnam. And I said, don't do it, because, you know, you and I have just formed a peace agreement for the first time, and the first thing you do is to invade another country. It shows that we're not peaceful in nature. He said, well, we'll be there just to punish Vietnam, because we have to do it as a matter of honor. And I said, well, if you will, do me a favor, don't stay very long. And he said, okay. And so they were only in Vietnam 2 weeks, and then they withdrew. That was in 1979. The Chinese have not been at war since 1979. So they're worried about this. But I think we're going to have to, I think that the best way for us to compete with China and win, if we want to have a victor or a loser, is for us to adhere to the principles that I mentioned earlier of peace and justice and democracy and freedom and environment and that sort of thing. So that's what I think we should do to compete with them successfully. There's no way that China's going to ever threaten the United States militarily. And I don't think they're ever going to threaten the United States politically either, unless they change and make the democracy that exists in their little villages prevail in their big cities and counties and provinces. I should point out very quickly that the little villages are not part of the Communist Party system. They're completely separate. The Communist Party starts at what they call townships, which is big cities, and then goes to counties and provinces. So I think eventually China is going to continue to move toward more democracy. I hope that Xi Jinping will bring that about. There's been a setback recently on Hu Jintao, but I believe that in the future we're going to see more freedom go to China. Right now, for instance, compared to when we normalized relations, China has made great strides toward human rights. When I normalized diplomatic relations with China, they had no freedom of religion. It was against the law to own a Bible. Now, the largest Bible-producing company on earth is in China, and the fastest-growing Christian country on earth is China. So they've made some progress, not enough. We've made a lot of progress, not enough. Both of us can improve toward all of those nice things that I mentioned earlier.
Mr. President, moving a little closer to home, and I know before you came here, we were talking about your favorite for the Academy Awards Best Picture tonight. So there were a number of questions. Let me try to roll them into one. There's been a bit of controversy relating to the movie Argo over the role played by Canadian Ambassador Ken Taylor and his embassy staff versus that played by the CIA in shepherding six U.S. diplomats to freedom during the 79 hostage crisis. Can you shed some light on these events? And are there any events that weren't captured in the movie that you can share with us?
Well, I was on the Piers Morgan show, and he's here in California to report on the Oscar presentations tonight, and that's why he concentrated on this particular issue. As a matter of fact, I was present when the hostages were taken in Iran, as most of you old enough would remember, and I was informed immediately that six of our hostages were not taken in the compound by the Iranians. They escaped. They went to two or three other places. And, for instance, the British and some others wouldn't take them in, so they finally wound up in the Canadian embassy and the DCM's office where they were taken in. And the Canadians were in great potential trouble then, because all of their diplomats could also have been taken hostage if they had been caught protecting Americans. And so Ken Taylor was the ambassador there. And Flora MacDonald was the foreign minister of Canada. I was faced with a very difficult position, too, because I wanted to keep it absolutely secret. And we finally worked out an agreement between the CIA and the Canadians that the American hostages would escape using Canadian passports. But you can imagine the difficulty, legally speaking, for the Canadian Parliament to issue false passports. So the entire Parliament had to go into secret session, the only time they've ever done that in history, and they did, and they voted to issue the 6 false passports. And they kept it secret. So the false passports went over there, and the hostages were permitted to leave. The movie role played by the American hero, he was only there a day and a half. Ken Taylor and them were there through the whole thing. And so when the Americans escaped, contrary to the very vivid end in the movie that brought me to the edge of my seat as well when I watched it, where this pickup truck outran a jet airplane taking off. I'm not criticizing Hollywood, but nobody ever knew that the 6 Americans had been in the Canadian embassy until they were safe in Switzerland. And my wife and I were invited to go to Queen's College in Canada last fall to receive honorary doctorate degrees, which we did. And so I watched Argo before I went because I knew that Ken Taylor and Flora McDonald were going to be in the audience. They had also seen the film. And my judgment is that 90% of the credit for that heroic and brilliant move should have been with the Canadians. And the movie ignores practically any contribution by the Canadians. So, but aside from that, it's a vivid, wonderful film. Not precisely factual, but I hope it gets the Best Picture Award. And you said one other thing. One other thing that hasn't ever been explored. On a different basis, we had CIA agents going into Iran fairly often. I see my message. And one time we had 4 CIA agents went in, and there was a very close relationship between Iran and Germany. Most of the Iranian leaders were educated in Germany. So we ordinarily used German passports. So these 4 Americans were leaving Iran and went through customs. And as they went through, one of them showed him his passport. He said, okay, go ahead. And he walked about 20 feet, and the customs agent said, wait, come back. He said, I've been a customs agent here for 20 years. I have never before seen a German passport with an initial on it. They always spell out the full names. And here, your name here is Ira H. Schifter. He said, I don't understand it. So the CIA agent thought very rapidly, and he said, well, I can have to confess, when I was born, my parents gave me the middle name of Hitler. And I have special permission to use the initial. So is that going through? That hasn't been told publicly before, by the way.
And you heard it here. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and that is, do you teach Sunday school at your church? And if so, who filled in for you today?
All right. I teach Sunday school every Sunday that I'm home in Plains, and we try to be home on Sundays. Sunday before last, I taught my 603rd lesson after I left the White House. And when I'm gone, my substitute teacher is a man named Mashuk Afkazada, who is an Afghan soldier who came to Fort Benning, Georgia, near Plains, to train during the time of the Shah. And while he was in Fort Benning training, the Shah was overthrown, and he couldn't go back home. So Mashuk stayed in America. He married a beautiful blonde girl from Columbus, Georgia, right nearby. And he heard about my being nearby. So he came over to hear me teach the Christian faith. He was a devout Muslim then. He accepted Christ. And now he's the best Christian in our church, and he is my substitute teacher. So a former Afghan Muslim is my substitute when I'm not home teaching Sunday school.
Our thanks to President Jimmy Carter. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Skip Rhodes, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.